Good evening. Welcome to the Adventurers Club of Los Angeles. My name is Rich Mayfield, member 1211. I'm the first vice president, your programs chair this year. We are still bringing you stories of adventure from the Adventurers Club, even though we are shut down and we can't have regular meetings. It's a huge bummer, but those are the times we live in. We're still trying to bring you cool stories of adventures around the world. So tonight I have with me Lieutenant Colonel retired, Troy Johnson, a B-2 pilot. So probably the scariest airplane out there. We're excited to hear about that story. Just a reminder, our guests, we're live. Thank you for watching. You can put questions and comments in the comment section. And at the end, we'll do a Q&A, and you can answer some of those questions for our viewers out there live. So, Lieutenant Colonel, how did you get involved in flying? When did you first figure out that you wanted to be a pilot? Like, what was the impetus behind?
Well, so the high school at the time, Seguin High School, a small town in Texas, central Texas there. I was a sophomore, I think, and I was starting to think about, okay, what did I want to do after I graduated from high school? And knew I wanted to go to college, but I wanted to figure out, okay, what did I want to do, you know, after college, thinking about careers and stuff. So I just happened to be in the library, and I saw this book about careers, so a big old huge book about careers. So I opened that up and started paging through that and looking at all the different things, and I went to this one page that talked about, you know, pilots. So that looks kind of neat. So I read through that to see, you know, what that career field was like, and then it tells you, well, how do you become a pilot? And so it talks about, you know, one of the avenues to become a pilot is to, you know, go through the military, go through pilot training. And in order to do that, you have to graduate from a college. And so ROTC, going through ROTC was one avenue. And then the Air Force Academy, which I'd heard about West Point, but never heard about, you know, the Air Force Academy. Yeah. And so I started researching, you know, ROTC. I applied for, you know, ROTC scholarships, and I also applied for the Academy. I actually got a Navy ROTC scholarship to Texas A&M. So I was, you know, looking at either going to the Navy route or the Air Force route, and I ended up getting selected for the Air Force Academy. So I chose to go to the Air Force Academy
over Navy ROTC, huh?
Yeah. So went to the Air Force Academy, and you get to do a little bit of flying there at the Air Force Academy. They have a soaring program there, and then towards your senior year, they have a pilot checkouts program there, small aircraft. It's essentially solo there out of
that is the like best way to get there, right? That's the top of the line, you know, grade A way to become a pilot is going to the Air Force Academy.
Yeah, because
flying at the Air Force Academy.
The one thing at least at the time, you know, back then, many years ago, was that as long as you were medically qualified and primarily you had good vision, you were pretty much guaranteed to go to pilot training. So back then they had enough pilot training slots that everybody that was medically qualified and wanted to go to pilot training could go. So that was probably the most, you know, guaranteed or sure path to make it to pilot training.
That's interesting, because when I was going through it, that was not the case.
Yeah.
You know, I looked at the Air Force Academy, and that's where I wanted to go first, right?
Then,
you know, the Navy recruiter got in my ear and said, hey, you know, the Navy has more planes and more pilot slots. I'm like, that's not true. Yeah. And I looked it up, and when I was applying, it was true. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
So I picked Navy.
Yeah.
But that's interesting to know that the Air Force Academy was, you know, just churning out pilots.
This is back, 82 when I graduated, and they were, you know, back then they had several pilot training bases. Many of those have closed down. We just have a few now, so they don't put out as nearly as many pilots, you know, as they did back then in the day there. So
you got some preliminary training at the Air Force Academy, along with a fantastic engineering education, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What did you major in there?
Astronautical engineering. So
the hardest one.
It was a tough one.
Aiming for the top the whole time. Mm-hmm. So what was the first, like when you got out of the Air Force Academy, where did you go for training after that?
So I went to Del Rio, Texas, Laughlin Air Force Base down there. So it's on the border of Texas and Mexico there. And
what are they training you to fly there?
So you start out flying T-37s, which is a small twin-engine jet, side-by-side seating. And so you spend about half of the, you know, program. It's a year-long program. You spend about half the time in the T-37, And then you progress to the T-38, which is, you're probably familiar with seeing the T-38. Mm-hmm. So it's still flying. So you fly the T-38, and you learn formation flight, acrobatics, how to navigate, and so all the basics of flying, high performance aircraft there.
So after training, kind of everybody spreads out to an actual platform, right? That they're going to be flying.
Yep.
So what after the training, what platform did you get?
Yeah, so
did
everybody,
you pick? Yeah. Did you pick, or like, is there a quality spread, or
Yeah, you get like a dream sheet, and you can pick what you want. And everybody, of course, most people want the fighters. At the time it was mm-hmm. the F-15 and F-16s.
So what was the top six on your list?
It was, I think, F-15 and F-16. And
yeah.
I ended up getting a B-52 to Minot, North Dakota, and I saw, no, this is not good.
is the B, because I know with the dream sheets, right?
Yeah.
Wherever you are in history and mm-hmm. with your class, there's always a last on the list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's always a, like, I don't know what the Air Force is now, but I think like Missileer is mm-hmm. probably like the, out of the Air Force Academy, you don't want to go to like a nuclear missile silo.
Yeah.
Like that's the,
yeah.
So what was the lowest on the sheet in your pilot class? What did nobody want to fly?
Well, yeah.
Not to throw any community under the bus, but let's throw a community under the bus.
Yeah, tankers weren't, weren't all that exciting. At least yeah. B-52s, you get to drop bombs, so that was
yeah.
so. But
so B-52s were somewhere in the middle, at least.
Yeah. In hindsight, there was really no bad platform. I mean, just getting the opportunity to fly, whether it was B-52, tanker, transport people. There was actually pilots that wanted to fly transport because you get flying transport aircraft like the C-141. You get mm-hmm. to see the world.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to go with the airlines, that was something that appealed to people, that because you could get a lot of time in like the C-141s and the other transport C-5s at the time. So there's different reasons for desiring different platforms. So.
Where was the B-52 on your list?
It was towards the bottom. Yeah,
so. It was on the list though. That's
yeah,
good.
It was on, yeah.
Okay, so you got a choice on your list. So I'm sure that the assignment officer, what we call them, detailers in the Navy.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was, everybody got, one of their top three choices.
Yeah, and at the time they had a lot of B-2 or B-52 assignments they needed to be filled. So I think there was more B-52 assignments than fighter assignments that they needed to fill.
Yeah.
So timing's everything.
So where do you say you get sent with the B-52s?
To Minot, North Dakota.
So I went
from
training.
Well, that's in, North Dakota, So yeah. I went from the border of Texas, Mexico to the border of North Dakota, Canada. Uh-huh. So I was on the border to border program and spent a couple of years in North Dakota, and coming from Texas, although I did spend 4 years at the academy in Colorado Springs, but it gets pretty dang cold up in North Dakota if you haven't been up there before.
So. I can imagine. Well, I don't know if I can imagine it. It's a different level of cold because, like Colorado Springs, mm-hmm. nice cold,
yeah.
snowing, it's
yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, it got a little cold today.
Yeah.
North Dakota, it's just like death cold.
Yeah, and a quick story about North Dakota. So you went up the B-52s up in North Dakota, and you have to pull alert. So you pull alert once every 3 weeks. So you spend a week in the mole hole, if you've ever heard about the mole hole. So it's like an underground facility. It's an alert. Back then, uh-huh. During the Cold War, so towards the end of the, the middle of the Cold War, towards the end of the Cold War. We pulled nuclear alert, and that's back when Strategic Air Command was still around. I don't know if you remember, heard that term, Strategic
so
Air Command.
Just so I'm clear, so the B-52s, their job was up there. They were close to Canada because they were going to fly over Canada.
Yeah,
over
you fly the Arctic Circle.
So tell me about that, the SAC, the Strategic Air Command.
Yeah, so Strategic Air Command. So you get checked out in the B-52 and the mission out there, and you get assigned to a crew. You're mm-hmm. assigned to a hard crew, so it's six people on the crew. You have a pilot, co-pilot, a navigator, and a radar navigator, a gunner, and an electronic warfare officer. So you have six crew members there that you work with and fly and train with, and you pull alert with. And so you do that every 3 weeks. You'd be on alert for 1 week at a time. And so you'd be, you spend your time in the mole hole. Every morning you get up, go pre-flight the airplane, make sure everything on the aircraft was operationally, functional. And then you just sit there, and they'd have exercises periodically where they ring the klaxon, and you have to run out to the airplane, start up the airplane, make sure everything starts up. In some cases, they'd give you a, they'd task you to taxi. So we used to call it the elephant walk. because we had five B-52s and five KC-135 tankers there on the alert pad. So they'd essentially do the klaxon, and in some cases you just start up and shut down. In some cases they wanted you to taxi, and so you'd taxi down the runway, and you'd have 10 of these airplanes, you know, taxiing down, and we call it the elephant walk.
How fast did they expect you to be off the ground?
Within minutes, you had to be because
7 minutes, 10 minutes.
You're
not allowed to say.
Because you have to get off the ground before the incoming. The concern back then was missiles coming from Russia,
right.
Of course, and so you had to be off the ground before those missiles could hit and take out the alert.
And to be clear, you're loaded for bear.
Yeah.
The alert pad, and by loaded for bear, I don't mean like buckshot and Mark 82s, right? Yeah. What were you carrying?
Well, nukes. I mean, it was nuclear alert. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So those were loaded up.
Yep.
Ready to go. Yep. And you could take off in minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was your job.
Yep.
Every 3 weeks.
Yep. Yep.
To sit there.
Yep. And so yeah, we'd do that. Uh-oh. And then every year you have a major exercise. They call it the ORI, the Operational Readiness Inspection.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually movies, on TV. I think there's one called Strategic Air Command. That's about an operational readiness inspection. But anyway, what happens is you have the inspectors. They come from, at this time, came from Omaha, Air Force Base, Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha. So they fly up in a 135 aircraft. They land. And they give you you typically know it's coming at some point, within a 30 or 60 day window, but you don't know exactly what day they're going to be there. So anyway, they come in, they land, and they all the inspectors get out, and you go into generating all the aircraft. Generating meaning that you load them up with the weapons and fuel and get it ready, for war. So the ORI aircraft comes in land, they get off the airplane, and we start generating the airplanes. So we go out to the alert pad and start generating the airplanes, and shortly thereafter it starts snowing. And we have so we're out there generating an airplane, in the middle of the night, and it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and now it's a full-blown blizzard. and so we're out there generating the aircraft, it's snowing like crazy. It's the coldest I've ever been because the airplane's like a refrigerator, it's like minus 20 outside, and we have heaters, but the heaters just weren't doing the job, we're trying to get the airplane up and running, and anytime anything breaks, the crew chief's answer is put heat on it to get it to work again.
So he's running around with a bunch of heat guns.
Well, yeah, they have the portable heaters, they have the big tubes, and they put heat on different things that aren't working. So we're trying to get the airplane up and loaded, and like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, they finally call it off because it was just getting too bad out there.
Yeah.
So at that time, I'm thinking this is probably not the place I really want to be. As far as stationed at Minot, North Dakota for too long. So the only way to get out of there was to volunteer for an overseas assignment. And the only overseas assignment available for B-52 pilots was Guam.
Huh.
So I applied to go to Guam, and I was lucky enough to get selected to go to Guam. So I got to spend a three-year tour of Guam, which was fantastic. I mean, just a fantastic place to be. You get to travel around,
So B-52s are based on Guam just for its forward...
Yeah,
position?
Back then they had a squadron of B-52s there at Guam, and we pulled alert at Guam as well.
Same thing, Strategic Air Command.
Yep. And so did a tour there, and we used to do, and B-52s back then we it was a low level mission, because you couldn't come in high because of the threats, in Russia. So it was a low level mission, and so you do a lot of training, in Minot, and the same in Guam. Then we'd fly all the way to Australia to do low levels.
Hmm.
And so that's like a 10-hour flight, 5 hours there, you do an hour or two low level and come back to Guam there. So, but it was a lot of fun. And that was, like I said, in hindsight, the B-52, I thought it was going to be the kiss of death. But the neat thing about it is you got to work with crew members and become a really, working with a team of people for, months, in some cases a year or so. And really, it's just a neat part of, working as a team together, trying to do a mission like that. So.
How much ground crew? How many people on the ground did it take to maintain that?
The airplanes, they typically you have a primary crew chief and a assistant crew chief, but then they have a whole back shop, you know, infrastructure.
That's for the squadron that's shared.
Yeah, I mean, usually, you know, the maintenance organizations are pretty sizable for, you know, for bomber aircraft just because of all the systems. You have offensive weapon systems, you know, the bombs that you drop. You have defensive systems, which the electronic warfare officer operates. You have the gunner. So the airplane itself, plus, you know, the airplane was pretty old at the time, you know, 1960s vintage. So trying to keep the airplanes running takes a lot of, you know, labor from the ground crew. And so they probably, it's probably, you know, 30 to 40 maintainers per airplane as far as what how they typically size the maintenance, you know, organization.
So I've got a question. You said there's six people that actually fly on the B-52, right? Mm-hmm. Which one of those guys actually has to press the button, so to speak?
So it's the navigators downstairs. They're the ones that, you know, it's the radar navigator. He's the senior.
The radar navigator is the guy that...
He's the senior person down there. You have the navigator that's doing the basic navigation of the airplane. You have the radar navigator that's looking on the radar scope trying to identify the target, you know, and he's giving, essentially doing fixed point updates, which updates the nav system, which determines when the weapons should come out, so...
And did you guys get, like, special psychological screening to make sure that you'd drop the bomb?
Well, you have to go through, they called it, it was called a PRP program at the time. So yeah, you have to be cleared, and there's a psychological, you know, evaluation to make sure, you know, everybody's, you don't have any, you know, anybody that's a nut job per se, but you have to go through psychological evaluations and to essentially be on a crew.
Do you guys have any really good scares when you were pulling alert? Like, oh shit, like, here it goes.
Yeah, no, just, I mean, they usually happen, you know, at odd hours, like in the middle of the night. I remember we did one alert response, and it was in the winter, it was icy outside, and we were all running to the, we called them six packs. They were these old blue pickup trucks. Uh-huh. You could get all six crew members. They were bench seats. There were three crew members up front, three crew members in the back. So I remember running to our six-pack vehicle, and I think it was a navigator, a radar navigator. He slips on the ice and he goes head first into the bumper of the truck there, and he's about unconscious. And so I just remember throwing him in the bed of the pickup, so we could get him out, because you don't know if it's the real thing or if it's just an exercise. You don't know it's an exercise until you get to the airplane. And you contact command post over the radios, and then they'll read you a code to tell you what it is there. So
yeah. Interesting.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, that was, you know, that's as far as you know.
And that's the guy that's got to drop the nuke.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I'm interested, because you went from there and eventually you got to a B-2, mm-hmm. but the B-52, I don't know. As a layperson, I would not describe that as one of the more survivable elements of the triad, mm-hmm. right?
It was
not stealth.
Yeah.
And it was very dangerous, and mm-hmm. it's coming at Russia.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts about if we ever had to go, what's the survivability there? Is it?
Well, that's why we did a lot of low-level flights, because the only way to get, you know, through the threats is you had to go in low. And so that's why, we every flight you fly a low-level mission there, and it's nighttime, of course. And so, you know, you do what you can to, you know, minimize, you know, being seen by the bad guys. And, you know, there's always, you know, certainly risk. But the other thing is, you're typically not going in by yourselves, right? Whether it's conventional or nuclear war, you're not out there by yourselves. You have other people, you know, and other systems that are helping you get there. So
once you got there, you're low level. Now, mm-hmm. what kind of yield are these warheads looking at? Like, you have to pop up to drop them?
I mean, they had different maneuvers, and it just depends on the mission as far as, you know, what the loadout was there.
So, it seems like if you're flying low and then mm-hmm. you're dropping a very, very, very large, mm-hmm. large warhead,
yeah,
that's not ideal.
Yeah, well, there's we call them escape maneuvers there. So there's essentially, it's designed such that you don't put the crew in harm.
That's pretty harrowing, though.
Yeah.
That's some serious stuff.
Yeah.
So you did 3 years in Guam. On mm-hmm. B-52s, mm-hmm. yeah. And then where did you go from there?
So
that was your ticket, right?
Yeah.
If you did Guam, you got to write your ticket.
So after that, you know, I had essentially fulfilled my commitment. Once you go through pilot training, you have 6 years that you owe the Air Force, and so I'd pretty much I was coming up on my commitment, so I needed to decide whether or not to get out
or to stay with the Air Force. I was supposed to go to Castle Air Force Base. At the time, I had gotten an assignment to Castle Air Force Base, and then I had also applied for test pilot school because they were looking for bomber pilots, because there was a program going on that they needed bomber pilots. So I applied for test pilot school. Was actually en route moving to Castle. I get the phone call and say, "Hey, you got selected to go to test pilot school." So I had to change gears and go to Edwards Air Force Base. So you go to Edwards Air Force Base, and before you get completely assigned, you have to go through what's called a five flight eval. So you fly five flights. I flew on a T-38. In some cases, some people fly on the T-37. But at the time, it was five flights on T-38. So we did that, came out to Edwards, did the five flight eval, passed that, and then after that, moved the me and my wife.
That's just making sure, because they already know you are a pilot.
But yeah.
That five flight eval is just to make sure that
final
you
check. Yeah. Yeah.
Are a good pilot, yeah. And your skills are
yeah.
still tight.
It's the final check to make sure, yep, this guy.
You haven't been
guy.
Slacking for the past 3
yeah.
years?
Yeah. So anyway, do that. Spend a year at test pilot school. Very, very demanding, year because you're flying up to 20 to 25 different airplanes. And so you have to, learn about these airplanes. They give you a flight manual and you get a few days to learn how to fly the airplane. And also you're doing academics. So you do flying in the morning typically and then academics in the afternoon. So you're doing, advanced, aero and other types of courses related to, testing aircraft there. So you spend a year, doing that. And then after that, then you get assigned to the various test squadrons there at Edwards or Eglin Air Force Base. And so after that, I got assigned to B-52 testing. We were testing weapons, cruise missiles at the time. And then spent a couple of years doing B-52 test. And then B-2 testing was also picking up. So B-2 had its first flight in 89. And I just graduated from test pilot school in 90 there. So
the B-2 is a brand new platform.
Yeah, brand new. So first flight was in July, 26th, 1989. And so anyway, I did B-52 testing for a couple of years and then went over to the B-2 program.
Let's pop up a picture of a B-2 because I feel like this is an appropriate time to just marvel at this engineering wonder. There it is. Mm-hmm. So this first flight was in 89.
89.
You graduated in 90 as a test pilot.
Yeah.
And this thing was coming online. So you were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And that's why, in my class, we had several B-52, or bomber, but not just B-52. We had B-1 pilots, B-52. So there's about six of us that had bomber backgrounds. And just about all of us, I think, ended up over at the B-2. We called it CTF, Combined Test Force, which is the organization that did the testing on the B-2. And so it's a combination of Air Force as well as contractors, Northrop Grumman contractors, which was a prime.
So do you know what number pilot you were to sit in that seat and fly it?
It's 39. So you get, when you fly.
39.
Yeah, yep. When you fly, actually, you get, just like about any other platform, you get hosed down and they get a coin with your spirit number on it. So it's so all the pilots would get a coin after their first flight in the B-2 there. So.
And as pilots, you refer to it as the Spirit?
Yeah, the Spirit. That's the nickname that the Air Force gave it. Was the Spirit there? Yeah,
that's cool.
And they also, they're named after states as well. Like the Spirit of Missouri was, I think, the pictures we were signing back there. So there's the states that were really supporters. The congressmen that were supporters of the program. Got an airplane named after the state. Yeah, so that's kind of how that works.
So what was your first airplane that you flew, or your first B-2? The first one was called the B-2 Spirit, right? Like it's the namesake, right?
Yeah,
kind of like the Los Angeles class submarine, the first.
Yeah, it was, I want to say it was, at the time we had six test airplanes there. They were AV-1 through AV-6. And I don't remember the state. I don't know if it was New York. I think it was AB3, which I think was New York at the time. But I'd have to go back and look at my records on that.
So this was an interesting plane because you're used to flying a B-52 and all these, I would say, fairly conventional aircraft. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a flying wing, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So handles a little differently and analog computer control, fly-by-wire.
Yeah.
And this, you said this was the second plane to be fly-by-wire?
Yeah, the F-16 was, you know, one of the first, you know, fly-by-wire, you know, airplanes that were, it was actually fielded there. So,
but this is a flying wing.
Flying wing, yeah. So a little bit, you know, little bit more as far as complexity and potentially risk too, because it's a flying wing. So.
Now, did you do simulator before you got in the?
Yeah. You do quite a bit of simulator. They have a, you know, training checkout program. We had, at the time, we had to do, I think, 6 simulator sessions. So you go down. It's Pico Rivera was where the they had the simulators at. So we drive from Edwards down to Pico Rivera and spend, you know, half day in the simulator, you know, doing different type of, you know, maneuvers and stuff and learning about the airplane. And so you do that and then you get to spend some time doing ground testing. There's quite a bit of ground testing that occurs during the test program. So you get to spend, you know, time in the cockpit on the ground,
right,
learning about the airplane and all the switchology and stuff. And
so all that's to say, though, is academically, you knew how to fly the plane and you simulator time, but what did it feel like, you know, being a, you know, fairly accomplished pilot? Mm-hmm. What did it feel like the first time, kind of your, I guess when your wheels leave the ground, mm-hmm, right, and you're in this thing? What would it feel like compared to other airplanes?
It's certainly an awesome feeling, and particularly coming from the B-52s, a B-52, an airplane older than I was, it had that old airplane smell, you know, an old, uh-huh, you know, we could used to call them steam gauges because they were all round dials.
Yeah,
and 1950s, you know, technology and going to a brand new airplane, still had that brand new airplane smell, you know?
Uh-huh.
and you know, glass cockpit, you know, very sophisticated avionics the B-52 was a beast of an airplane. You had to manhandle that airplane to get it to, uh-huh, go where you wanted to, whereas the B-2 had a stick, you know, B-52 had a big yoke, 8 throttles. The B-2 had, you know, stick and 4 throttles because for the 4 engines, but just a, you know, very nice flying airplane. And you know, as far as just comparing it to other airplanes, because in test pilot school you get to fly a wide variety of airplanes, but the B-2 flies as well as any conventional, you know, airplane that has a, you know, conventional tail on it. But just, mm-hmm, because it's a fly-by-wire, you can design the airplane to fly like you want. So.
So yeah, I would think that it would be a little like fishy, right? Because it doesn't have that horizontal stabilization. But you're saying that the control system,
yeah, the computers compensate for all that. So it's so essentially you're giving commands to the computers, and the computers send the commands to the flight controls to you know, essentially give you, you know, what is essentially what flying like a conventional airplane. So.
Huh. So what's the crew like on a B-2?
So you got a pilot and a mission commander on the B-2. Originally, when they first designed it, they were actually looking at putting three crew members on the airplane. So a pilot, a co-pilot, and a weapon system officer in the third seat, which was supposed to be behind the two pilot seats. But they, about, you know, halfway through the development program, they decided to pull out that third seat, just to go with 2 air crew members, a pilot.
I've heard that they put a coffee maker there. Is that true?
Yeah. Now that they during the test testing, we didn't have any of the, you know, the galley, you know, accommodations.
But now you have a coffee maker.
Yeah, they've got some accommodations now.
Because these things run some long missions, right?
Yeah, yeah. And during the test program, you have an instrumentation system on the airplane, and there's instrumentation racks. And so the behind us, most of the cockpit, available cockpit area, was filled with instrumentation equipment.
Right.
Yeah. So.
So what's the longest mission that you flew in it?
It's between 16 and 17 hours, so it was a flight to Guam there. So we flew to Guam, and off of Guam there's a small island where it's a weapons range, and you can go there, drop some weapons, and then land on Guam there, so at Anderson Air Force Base.
So you took off from where?
Whiteman Air Force Base.
Whiteman,
yeah.
And then you flew all the way to Guam?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you landed in Guam?
Yep.
16, 17
yep.
hours.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So how do you battle fatigue in a platform like that?
Yeah, so what they did was a lot of preparation, you know, particularly for before they went to Kosovo. As the lead up to that, you know, they were concerned about, because those missions were going to be, you know, 30 hours plus, and even after that. So they brought in some sleep specialists.
They gave you drugs?
They talked about, you know, how to manage your sleep as far as, you know, before, you know, preparing for, you know, the day before or a couple of days before, getting your sleep cycles in order, They talked about what to eat as far as nutrition-wise, exercise. And when you go on, and I didn't get a chance to fly the combat missions, but talking to the pilots that did go on it, it's like going on a camping trip. You've got, because you're going to be on the airplane for a day or 2 days, so you've got to pack everything that you're going to need for the next couple
of days. Catch your Cliff Bars.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like that. And so what they would do, they would cycle off where, you know, a pilot would take a power nap, you know. And we didn't have bunks on the airplane. So what they did is they went down to the local Walmart and got these cots, you know, these lounge chairs, and they fit perfectly behind the pilot seats there.
Yeah.
So you could go back and lay down, and you could get, you know, a power nap. And so, you know, they had recommended, you know, amount of time that to sleep, and then they'd trade off, you know, between crew members. And so they'd do that, you know, off and on, going before they got into theater there. The challenge, particularly for the, you know, as far as being able to sleep, talk to the pilots that did that, was they were on such an adrenaline high going there. It's hard to sleep, you know, when you know what's in front of you there. And then, you know, after you drop your weapons and you have a huge load drop off your shoulders that you made it through and, you know, made it through all that, okay, and got your weapons out. And the challenging part was coming back. And typically for those long missions, particularly when they were going to Afghanistan and coming all the way back either to Whiteman or going to another base, the air refueling is one of the more demanding tasks. And, you know, having to do air refueling, you know, 30 hours into a mission, sometimes at nighttime, you know. And
just not into it.
Yeah, it could be in the weather. So a very demanding, you know, time. And you have to get the gas in order to make it back home, right?
Right.
And so those were the most challenging, because at that point the fatigue, you know, could really impact you there. So you did have, they did give you the option, as far as pills, going back to pills, you could take a pill, they called them go pills, if you needed the extra, you know, to get over that.
They call them something nice, right?
Yeah, to get you back home. But they call them, go pills, and you, at the time that you could actually take Ambien to sleep before the mission, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they had no go, and they had go pills at the time that they could use. So, and you had to, of course, you had to. There was a regimen. You had to get checked out by a physician before you
to make sure that you weren't on speed.
Yeah, to make
all
sure
the time. Yeah. This is only for the 16-hour plus missions.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, there's a lot of physiology that went into it. You know, making sure, you know, trying to manage your sleep cycles as best you can. There's, you know, again, a combination of, you know, nutrition and trying to get your, you know, power naps in when you can.
And just kind of being stuck in a cockpit for all that time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the ejection seats, you know, they're not very comfortable, you know, so it's in your, so.
And someone's got to be in one at any given time.
Yeah, you got to have somebody in the seat, you know.
Even though the plane is basically flying itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's got, you know, autopilot, you know, and it's got a mission plan that it flies, so you're just sitting there monitoring. You do have to, we didn't have auto throttles, so that's one thing that required, you know, attention. You had to monitor airspeed, mm-hmm. so you had to keep on top of that, so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you did operational tests on these guys.
Yeah. So I did developmental tests at Edwards for 3 years, and then did a tour at the program office at Dayton, and then went to Whiteman Air Force Base, and they have we had an operational test squadron there, so we did operational testing.
And when you say operational testing, can you explain to me what that means? What exactly are you trying to do with the operational test?
So it's a combination of evaluating when we get new capabilities, whether it's new hardware, new software, new weapons. We'd go out and essentially verify the weapons, what we refer to as suitable and effective. They could accomplish the mission that they were intended for. And then as part of that, you would develop tactics on how to employ weapons or whatever systems you were given to test there. So
you're kind of figuring out how the Air Force is going to use this platform.
And then that information goes into a manual, and then that manual is essentially used to train the crews.
So you literally wrote the book?
Well, helped write.
I mean, it's a team effort.
Yeah.
But you helped write the book
certainly
on how to fight this thing.
Yeah, you're certainly part of the team that did that. Yeah.
So it is a pretty amazing platform. Mm-hmm. I read that it can carry 80 JDAMs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's quite a few.
Yeah,
because by comparison, like a nuclear submarine, if it's loaded with Tomahawks, can only carry, you know, 120-ish. I forget, maybe 150.
Yeah.
Tomahawks.
Yep.
Less if it's like a Los Angeles class, right? Mm-hmm. So in terms of like a weapon system, that's a lot of bombs.
Yeah.
80 individual bombs. And we were talking to the F-16 pilot last week. He was saying when you guys came on scene, mm-hmm. you know, they'd have, you know, 4-6 JDAMs. Mm-hmm. And the B-2 would report in and they'd say like 34 or 60 or something.
Yeah.
Just everybody would go home.
Yeah, you know, when it was first used in combat was in the Kosovo, and at the time we had it was the first time that GPS aided munitions were employed in combat, and at the time we could only carry them on the rotary launchers, so we could only carry up to 16 total, 8 on each side, GPS aided munitions. But which was a game changer back then, even just having 16 GPS.
Because Kosovo was early 90s, right?
Late 90s.
Late 90s. So you were on the plat. It came out in 89, mm-hmm. and then it was in the test phase for how long? So
first flight was 89. So it did developmental testing all the way through 1997. At Edwards Air Force Base, and then they transitioned to what we refer to as initial operational test and evaluation, and then follow on operational test and evaluation. So the operational testing was occurring out at Whiteman. Development the airplane was still being tested. We had follow on systems that were being tested at Edwards.
But it was operational for Kosovo.
Yeah, it was operational for Kosovo back in it was 98-99 time frame there.
And that was a huge game changer, right? Because the first GPS guided munitions before, we were just, we were pretty good with bombs, right?
Yeah.
But we weren't, 6 feet mm-hmm. good.
Yeah, and the combination of the stealth, along with being able to deliver, GPS guided weapons, the all night, which gave you an all night or all weather capability. We had precision guided weapons, laser guided weapons. Mm-hmm. That had been used, for many years before that. The problem with laser-guided weapons was, particularly in that theater over Kosovo, you have weather, a lot of the time, much of the year.
Right.
So laser-guided weapons don't work very well if you have a cloud deck, that's between you and the target
right.
you're trying to see. So, and so did the GPS, aided munitions, and that really sold. Everybody was unsure, because it'd be too very expensive airplane. We thought, there's no way we're going to put something like that expensive at risk.
What do you mean put it at risk?
As far as, because you wouldn't want something like that getting shot down,
But isn't the point of it?
Yeah, the point of it, but you only have 20 of them, so there was concern about that.
And it was unproven, right?
It was unproven, yeah.
Because I've heard the radar.
You always had your naysayers, had your naysayers, but it proved itself and at the time, and everybody was, just ecstatic as far as how well it performed, and it really... after that, everybody wanted the B-2 to be part, to support whatever operations, they had. It really sold itself and convinced everybody that, it was really, an awesome, system to deal with. So.
Now, when you did operational testing, did you test the stealth capability? Did you test how it worked against our weapon systems? Could our weapon systems acquire it? I know there's some pretty advanced stuff out there.
Yeah, well, I can't really talk about,
whether or not our stuff
can... But we do, that's part of the development as well as the operational testing. You test it against other systems to see what its capabilities are. So, you characterize the performance.
So I've heard that it can't get wet and maintain its stealth capabilities.
There was a cartoon about that and one of the major newspapers about that. And that wasn't necessarily the case. We did a lot of developmental testing in weather when we were at Edwards. And again, another funny story about weather testing. We had a test airplane called the Miss Piggy. It was a converted C-135.
Uh-huh.
They'd tear out the back end of the airplane, and they put some of the systems in the B-2 in the back end of the airplane. And we would fly that aircraft all over to essentially gather data and essentially support the development of the B-2. And we used to go, we would fly low level in that airplane out at Edwards. There's a route called the Haystack Butte route, and we'd run up and down in that Miss Piggy. At low altitude and in the heat of the day, you get a lot of turbulence, particularly in the afternoon, uh-huh. you get beat up pretty bad in the back of that airplane. So some people, you could refer to it as a vomit comet in the back there, but on a you know.
Isn't the vomit comet the one that does the parabolic?
But you get you get quite a few people sick in the back of the 130, the Miss Piggy is what we called it. But anyway, we'd go out and do testing and, with Miss Piggy, doing essentially TF testing in weather.
TF testing, what's that?
Low altitude terrain following. And to verify if the system works.
Terrain following. So that's an automatic system that's...
Yeah. Although in Miss Piggy, you had to hand fly it. But you do all this check out Miss Piggy first before it goes to the bomber. So and we would go up and evaluate it in rain. And so there's no rain, you know, typically in the Antelope Valley, so it's very sparing. So we'd have to go up north to go test it in rain. So we'd go up to Washington State, and we'd go. We went to a small airport in Yakima, and so we'd go. We'd do essentially approaches to the airport there, and do multiple approaches in the rain, testing out our TF radar. And we did that. I think we did that once or twice, and we got a phone call back at the base there, and it said, don't ever come back here again, because the Miss Piggy was an old model, KC-135. It was the A model, which had really loud engines, the really smoky engines. So it wasn't
the contrail people are coming after you.
Yeah, particularly for a place like Yakima, you have this smoking loud aircraft. Yeah. Doing multiple patterns, hours on end, and said, don't ever come back here again. So anyway, we.
But the B-2, they have. Like climate control hangars, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty sensitive aircraft.
Yeah, but to finish the story there, but so we end up, after we did the testing in the Miss Piggy, we sent up a B-2 to Yakima. And they said, it's like an air show, said, come back anytime you want.
So, wait, isn't that not a good thing if they saw it?
Yeah.
Isn't the point? It was there.
When you're flying over, the tower, they can see you there. There's just to kind of point out the majesty of the B-2, as far as the.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. I want to show some of these other pictures that you sent us. Andy, look at that. Man. Mm-hmm. And then. This was the one I was talking about, that from the side it kind of looks like a hawk, right? Have you seen this picture?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yep.
How fast does it go? How fast can you tell me it goes?
It's a 0.8 Mach. So
0.8?
There's...
Yeah, because it's stealth, right? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want to go any faster.
You don't need the speed. I mean, it's the stealthiness that protects you there. So.
Is there like a stealth mode, like... that you can fly in like a non-stealth mode?
There's different modes of the airplane, depending on where you're at in the mission.
So like you can go faster or whatever, or is the maneuverability, because I would imagine that even like if you pull a hard maneuver and use a lot of control surfaces or too much thrust or whatever, that's going to compromise your stealth factor, so to speak. Like the smallest is like, I've heard that it's like a 1 square foot radar cross section. I mean, there's not, so like a giant bird, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it could get more than that, right? Because it, that's bigger than 1 square foot. That,
and I can't really talk about
it. You can't talk about it. But it has different modes.
Yeah, it has different modes.
And it can be more or less stealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I want to show this other picture, the one with the motorcycle. You got that up there? So you got a stealth motorcycle.
Yeah, this was...
What mode does that operate in? Is it quiet? Is it electric?
It's loud. It's loud and powerful.
It's loud?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is...
So this is you and your wife?
Yeah, it's me and my wife. And this was, I think, the 25-year anniversary. So they had opened up they had the airplane out there for display for all the employees at Palmdale at Plant 42 there. And they had... and the program had contracted with Orange County Choppers to build that stealth bike.
Now that's Orange County, New York, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they built a stealth bike for you guys.
Yeah. And so that was...
Did you ride it?
No, I didn't get a chance to ride it. There's a couple of guys that are checked out that ride it there. But
But it's, so they keep it up. That's at Edwards. They keep it up there.
Well, the motorcycle was at Palmdale for several years. I think it's up in. We have another facility up at Tinker Air Force Base, and I think that's where it's sitting.
And guys have to be qualified to ride it.
Yeah, you have to be qualified.
Is there a checkout?
Yeah, there's checkout.
You don't want to. You got to get your motorcycle safety course.
It's
all
a one of a kind, so you don't want to lay it down.
So there's let. How many people do you think have ridden that motorcycle?
Probably, I don't know, probably a half dozen people.
So less than B2 pilots?
Oh, yeah.
Are all of them that have ridden it B2 pilots?
No.
I feel like some crew chiefs got in on that action.
No, I'm not sure we've had, I don't know of any of the pilots that actually rode it.
The chief took that bike.
Yeah, the program manager got to ride it. I know that.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah.
So how many B2 pilots are there? Because you said you were 39.
39. Yeah. So there's over 1,000. I think they went over 1,000 in the last year.
But you're making that sound like it's a big number. You're saying there's over 1,000. That's not a lot. There's not many more than 1,000.
Yeah.
Because how many B2 aircraft are there?
Well, there's 20 now. There used to be 21, but then we lost one at Guam. Yeah.
I heard about that. What happened? What happened with that?
I can't really talk about the details of that. We just, but we did lose one. The two crew members got out.
I heard that not a static port. I heard a port was clogged. So you got false readings. You can't talk about that?
I can't talk about
that. I feel like that's readily available information on the internet.
I just know what I can
read on the internet is like a port got clogged, right?
Yeah.
But you sound like, if you can't talk about it, that means that you might have been involved in the investigation and might know more.
No, there's certain things as it relates to accidents that we can't, we ourselves
as
can't,
someone
can't,
who
can't
actually knows.
The public. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So there's rules we have to comply with there. So,
So after the B2, you got out, right? Mm-hmm. What made you decide to stop flying the B2 and get out of the Air Force?
Well, the next assignment was probably going to be a non-flying assignment, either going back to Dayton or to the Pentagon. And I decided, well, time to go start on a second career and do something else. And so got out of the Air Force, retired 2003, and was looking for flying a job at the time, whether it was for like FedEx or UPS or one of the airlines. But at the time, they weren't hiring.
What do you think that would have been like? I always wonder this of pilots, right? Because I see, F-18 guys pick up a job at Delta.
Yeah.
What's that like moving from the B-2 stealth bomber? Literally, is there any plane that there's 20 B-2s? There's fewer space shuttles, but they're not flying anymore.
Yeah.
But that's probably like the pinnacle of aviation. Mm-hmm. I don't know, how many SR-71s are there?
There was, I think, on the order of 20-ish or so, I think, SR-71s. Yeah.
But this is one of the most rare aircraft.
Yeah.
The fewest people have ever flown this, the space shuttle notwithstanding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you're thinking about going to a... So how does that work in your pilot brain? Find the... Because you flew the absolute coolest plane ever made.
Yeah, yeah.
Argue maybe the SR-71.
Yeah.
But one of the coolest planes ever made.
Yeah.
And then you're like, maybe I'm going to go get a job flying for FedEx.
Yeah, yeah.
Where does that?
Well,
explain to me that logic.
Yeah. Well, at that point in your career, it's you start getting out of the flying game and more into the management side of things there. So there are opportunities for flying as you senior level positions, but those are fairly limited. So at any rate, we were looking to at least I was looking for to start my second career, and
so it's just that old man time.
Yeah,
flying's a young man's game, and
we all have to
give up things as we move on with our lives.
Yeah, start thinking about the future there.
You didn't end up flying for.
Yeah, so the because they weren't hiring at the time, and I got a phone call out of the blue from a guy named Luce Fedinko, and I had worked with him. Out at Edwards, he was a Northrop Grumman, one of the Northrop Grumman pilots, and he was manager at the time. And he was getting ready to retire, called me up, asked me if I was interested in applying for his job. So I applied for his job and was fortunate enough to get it. And so the story, there's a story behind that. if you've been in the Antelope Valley, in the Antelope Valley is, of course, you know, the Mojave Palmdale, Plant 42, Edwards Air Force Base area up there. So if you've been to the Antelope Valley once, you're destined to come back a second time. That's the curse of the Antelope Valley. You're destined to come back a second time.
If you work there.
Because I never, after we left, we enjoyed our time the first time we were there when the Air Force, and, you know, because you get to do a lot of great flying, but we never really thought about going back there afterwards. Mm-hmm. But that's the curse of the Antelope Valley. So I've been there once, back there again. So.
Edwards has had some really cool stuff happen.
Oh, yeah. If you're going to be in tests, that's the place to be.
I remember going out there as a kid and seeing the space shuttle land.
Yeah.
Yep. That was so cool.
Yeah.
So lots of cool stuff going on.
Yeah, I could see
there.
The space.
But not
land.
A great place to live and raise a family.
Yeah. It's
it's, know, not the most fun place.
Yeah. It's, you know, if you're willing to drive a couple hours, you can get to some pretty neat places.
That's true.
You can get to the coast, LA, Vegas. So it's, if you're willing to hop in the car and drive a little bit, you can get some.
Did you do a lot of that with your family? And
yeah, I mean, we did, got into hiking. We did the Mount Whitney, and did a couple of 14. We did what Mount Langley, which is another 14,000 footer. So we did, spent some time in the Sierras. We'd go to the coast.
And Southern California is amazing for that.
Yeah.
But Edwards is hot. And
it can get a little bit hot, a little warm.
So you're back there.
Yeah.
Working for an aerospace, Northrop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you've worked on some pretty cool programs, right?
Mm-hmm.
You worked on that the UCAV program. Can you explain what that is?
Well, it was the initially the UCAV, which was a joint program, and then the other services decided not to proceed with it. So,
but what kind of plane was it?
So it was a combat. It was an unmanned combat air vehicle or aircraft system.
So a drone.
Yeah, it was called
like UCAS. The Predator.
It became NUCAS after the Navy became the primary service, and the other services decided not to continue.
This was our first foray into like a completely unmanned fighter. Not like a Predator. I feel like a Predator.
Yeah, Northrop Grumman had, developed the Global Hawks, which had been flying for several years now. And those were ISR platforms, surveillance, reconnaissance, intelligence platforms. But yeah, the X-40, the UCAS was the first really unmanned combat, vehicle, or designed to be a combat vehicle.
And was this before they strapped some missiles on the Predator and the Reaper, I think they called it?
Yeah, I'm not sure timing-wise, when that occurred versus when we started flying the X-47s, but that was the point of that whole development exercise was to prove that you could develop an unmanned aircraft and it could perform a combat mission, and specifically for the X-47B. Was could it land on a carrier? Could it take off from a carrier? Could it land on a carrier? Which is one of the toughest, maneuvers that a manned aircraft can do is land on a.
And you guys did it.
Yes.
Landed this thing on a carrier.
And then one of the other challenging maneuvers is air-to-air refueling, and we did that with the X-47 as well. So. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
So how well did it land on a carrier?
Well, it's
better than people.
Yeah, better than
For all the fighter pilots watching that have trapped on carriers.
Yeah. So it could do. A very precise, within a, a very small footprint land and do it repeatedly. Yeah. So.
Because isn't that one of the things that the pilots do? They like have their chart up of like where they drop their hook.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things they compete off of who can be. So where.
You're looking for, I guess, the two wire or the three wire, I think, because they have four wires typically.
Right. So the UCAV hit the right wire every time
it can
in the right
it.
Spot.
Yep.
But then. We gave up that program. What happened?
The Navy decided to go a different route as far as the mission that they wanted to pursue, and it was essentially a more of a tanker mission, and so we elected not to pursue that. But we still have the airplanes, and so
they still work. They can still land on carriers and do their thing.
Yeah. So they're still.
But the Navy decided that if they were going to make anything a drone, they were going to make a tanker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Drone.
So that was what they decided to go with for now. And I think eventually one of the services will take a look at a combat drone again there. So I think it's just a matter of time. So.
Why do you think that the Navy didn't want to do that? You're an Air Force guy. You can talk some trash on the Navy.
Yeah, that's. I don't know if it may have been too big of a leap, for them to go from from essentially like what we got a lot of experience in with ISR platforms, General Atomics with the Predators and the Global Hawks, and making that leap to a combat aircraft.
I know there's some I don't know if there's ethical or moral concerns that people, it was an autonomous aircraft, but mm-hmm. there's always a man in the loop, right?
Yeah.
So the difference is on an F-18, mm-hmm. the man in the loop is in the cockpit, mm-hmm. versus the UCAV, the man in the loop or men in the loop are somewhere, in combat control.
Yeah, essentially, the only thing that's different is the cockpit's on the ground now. You still have pilots, that are flying the mm-hmm. vehicles for in some cases they can go fully, Global Hawks can go fully autonomous. You don't have
carry out their profile.
Yeah, but there's always a pilot, in the, essentially controlling the vehicle for the most part. And but if you lose, link, the vehicle will fly itself and go back,
right.
go fly its mission plan route, so.
But I feel like the fear, because you know, people think unmanned vehicle, mm-hmm. this thing's going to go take off and go shoot us up Terminator style. It's going to go Skynet, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But that was never the issue. I mean, I feel silly asking a question that to a guy that knows this stuff, but I think that's what people think of when they think of unmanned aerial vehicles that are armed, is that you gave the robots guns.
Yeah.
I think people fundamentally have a problem with that.
Yeah, there's always still a person in the loop. So
how do you feel about that as a pilot? Because I think pilots too mm-hmm. would rather be in the cockpit in the air mm-hmm. doing the shooting as opposed to in a sea container in Nellis or something.
Yeah, the different types of challenges as far as being a pilot on the ground in what we refer to as a ground control segment versus being in the air. I mean. Flying just being out there on your own and flying an aircraft is pretty neat
Would you have wanted to be a pilot if it was just going into a air conditioned box if the cockpit was on the ground?
Yeah, I mean there are certainly challenges for the pilots. One of the challenges that we have with flying the airplane from a cockpit on the ground is you don't have the luxury of all the senses that you'd have flying an airplane, a manned airplane, mm-hmm. and being in the cockpit, because when you're flying an airplane, you have the senses of feel, because you're flying the airplane, you can feel how the airplane's performing through the stick, you can hear the engines in your ear, you can smell, if you've got a fire, you can smell that, mm-hmm. You can look out the window and see, where you're going. Whereas flying an unmanned vehicle, you don't have the benefit of those extra senses. You're looking; it's all you're looking at monitors, monitoring what the vehicle's doing there. So that's you have different challenges as far as flying manned versus unmanned. So.
Do you think that's less of an issue as these platforms go to a fly-by-wire system? Like if it was the B-2, how much of that feel do you actually need?
The airplanes have certainly become, more automated as far as, just flying, the basic route. What's become more complex is now you can add a lot more capability, a lot more systems. So managing the system, just like on the B-2, that was the more challenging of the jobs. You had the pilot was in the left seat, you had the mission commander in the right seat. The pilot was responsible for flying the airplane, essentially. The mission commander was responsible for managing the systems, and the mission commander was the more senior position because he was managing the weapons and all the other systems on the airplane. And so that was, as far as workload, that was typically more workload because now you can put more systems, particularly on an unmanned platform. You can put more capability. You have more people that can, control or monitor the systems on the ground now. So
how do you objectively look at how much a pilot or a co-pilot or the mission commander has to do in the cockpit? Is there a way, as you're designing these platforms?
We do workload assessments. We have mm-hmm. Human factors engineers that we work with. And so we do workload assessments. They'll give the pilots certain tasks to fly. And it starts actually very early on. We do it in the simulators. They'll give the pilots different tasks to fly. And so we'll fly those a task, and we'll use that to evaluate the flight controls, the handling qualities of the airplane. They'll give you a maneuver as far as a landing maneuver, and they'll tell you, hey, we want you to land, 1,000 feet down the runway at a certain airspeed. And you'll do that maneuver, and they'll change different things. They can change the control laws in a simulator mm-hmm. and see. And then you as a pilot will determine, was it harder for me to land 1,000 feet down the runway, or was it easier? And we've got essentially a little matrix or flow chart that we go through and give a rating, based off how the airplane performed. And so you have maneuvers like that. You have, landing maneuvers. You have up and away maneuvers where you may track a target, or you may do a simulated air refueling. And so you have those types of tasks that you'll do, and essentially you'll give a rating, and the engineers will take that information back and decide, what changes they need to do in order to reduce aircrew workload.
And are we basically just maxing these guys out with systems? Like, we reduce the workload and then we add systems on top, give them something else to do, the platform?
Yeah, because just the huge variety of weapons. You probably don't have a picture, but you've probably seen pictures of the B-2 with all the weapons, lined up in front of the airplane. So you have a wide variety of weapons that the airplane can carry, and you can carry different combinations of those. And on all those weapons have unique ways to deliver them. So you have to be familiar with how to essentially deliver the weapons. If you're delivering a set of weapons over a very short span. There's a lot going on because you're monitoring the weapons, making sure they're ready to go. You have to be on airspeed altitude. You have to make sure the weapons power up. So there's a lot of things that you're monitoring. If something goes wrong, that's where it becomes challenging, because now, you have seconds. If something happens, before you're trying to deliver a weapon, you have seconds to figure out what to do to try and resolve that problem. Otherwise, you'll end up not being able to drop the weapon, and you won't be able to execute the target there. So,
but theoretically, if you put the cockpit on the ground, you can put a lot more people in that cockpit, right?
Yeah, you can certainly you can
distribute
more
that workload to however many people you need.
Yeah, you can have more, and plus you can swap out. Instead of flying 30 or 40 hours, you can swap out crews, so you don't have the fatigue issue that you.
So you could. So if you did this to a B-2, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have any crew fatigue. You could have guys that mm-hmm. that fly it over there mm-hmm. that are just basically sitting there, and then you have your mission commander that does the important part at the end, right?
Yep, yeah. You could swap out.
Is this a picture of that UCAV?
Yeah, that's it's the UCAS or the X-47B, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yep. Man. So we have a couple of those, and the Navy decided that they didn't want it. That's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah, they didn't want to go that route as far as pursuing that particular mission. Yeah. At least for the time being. But like I said, I think it's only a matter of time before we see that capability
coming out more.
Yeah.
So now, and there's also a new bomber coming out, the B-21, right? Mm-hmm. You know anything about that?
The only thing I can say that Northrop Grumman is
Wow, look at that.
The prime contractor for it. So. Yeah.
You guys are the prime contractor,
mm-hmm.
and that's all you know.
That's all I can say.
So I'm sure we got a ton of questions in the chat, because mm-hmm. this is just fascinating. I mean, that platform is just the scariest. I was telling, I don't know if we were talking earlier, but mm-hmm. When they talked shock and awe, mm-hmm. I can't even imagine being on the business end of a B-2.
Yeah.
Like if you saw that thing, because shock and awe kind of got made fun of as a strategy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? People are like, oh, they're just going to run away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man. Can you imagine being in a foxhole and you don't have your SAM site anymore, mm-hmm. or you can't turn your SAM site on, or you turned your SAM site on and a harm took it out and blew mm-hmm. it up, right? Yeah. So you have no SAM site. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have AA, but basically you're just in a foxhole waiting for us to come at you.
Yeah.
And then you see that B-2 coming straight at you. Mm-hmm. That would be crazy.
Yep.
The scariest platform.
Probably not a good place to be.
Did you feel like you were a badass when you were flying that thing? Like, did you feel scary?
Yeah, there's certainly a certain amount of esteem just being able to, being selected to fly the airplane, yeah.
I mean, it's basically like a two-man nuclear submarine.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. Like,
yeah.
Nuclear submarines have some unique capabilities, obviously.
Yeah.
But in terms of, firepower,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot there.
Oh, yeah. It's it's an awesome, awesome capability there, so, yeah.
All right, do we have any questions in that chat, Andy?
We sure do. Thank you so much, Rich, and thank you for everyone.
This is our Q&A session.
Thank you to everyone for tuning in. First question of the night comes from Robert Starling, and he wants to know, how does the B2 compare to a fighter? There is those who say that the B2 flies like a fighter. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so it flies, like I said, a conventional aircraft, like other large aircraft. It is pretty maneuverable, not quite as maneuverable as a fighter. You know, we can't do barrel rolls or aileron rolls. Yeah.
Did you try? Operational test guy.
Yeah, no.
Never in a simulator?
You could do it. You could try it in a simulator, but
did it work in a simulator?
You could probably get it to work in the simulator, but yeah, but you wouldn't want to do it on the aircraft because there's only 20 of them. So, and if you got caught doing that, that'd be the last flight you flew. So,
and you'd be the only guy that did a barrel roll in a B2.
Yeah. but as far as handling qualities wise, it flies great for large for an airplane that size. It doesn't turn as rapidly as a fighter, aircraft would roll. And it's not quite, not as maneuverable. It's fighters like the F-16 can pull 9 Gs,
Right.
And so we're not pulling near that many Gs. So it's a different mission. So you don't need to pull those Gs. You don't need to be as maneuverable. So
you don't need to fly straight up.
Yeah. No.
So. What else we got? Next question, Andy.
Next question is from Reggie Sully, and they want to say, thank you for joining us tonight. What would you consider your most interesting or most exciting flight?
Interesting or exciting flight?
That one in Guam? Just kidding.
Yeah. No, the most exciting flights were all, I think, when we were doing low-level testing. We did quite a bit of low-level testing, particularly to the north of Edwards Air Force Base. You got the Sierras up there, and they have low-level routes. And so that was always, a lot of fun. You'd get down to 200 feet, off the deck.
Wow.
And flying, and then you'd fly, fly down in the valleys and go over the, the mountaintops. And that was, pretty neat, being down low, going fast. And so.
And that was assisted by a system, like a radar system.
Yeah, it's a train following. So you essentially, the airplane's flying itself, and you're just monitoring. You're there to take control if you need to.
What kind of mountain can it take?
One of the routes actually goes by just to the south of Mount Whitney. I think it was the blue route. And so I don't know if you're familiar with that area, but you got the Owens Valley. You go over the White Mountains, you dive down into the Owens Valley, and you come back up. So those routes, would take you up, over 12 or 13,000 foot peaks.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's
pretty tight.
Yeah. Yep. So that was always
those low level flights.
Yeah, interesting and fun.
You call it TF?
Terrain following. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Next question, Andy. Please.
Speaking of low level, when you mention low level, how low is that?
We could go down to 200 feet. 200 feet was the system, the lowest we could go as far as in the
B2. That's another one from Reggie Sully. Mm-hmm. Next question is, what was your call sign and how did you get it?
At the time, particularly in bombers, we weren't quite like the fighter community where we had, nicknames per se. I guess later on, I got a call sign called Bat Guano.
Bat Guano?
Bat Guano. So if you're familiar with the movie Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah.
So there's one of the characters in there, his name is Bat Guano.
Interesting.
Yeah, so.
So was that from your B-52 days, you said?
Yeah, that was required. That was required reviewing or watching. Is that... during alert.
sub guys say that Down Periscope's the best submarine movie. Dr. Strangelove the best alert?
Yeah, there are certain movies you have to watch, if you're in SAC.
Did you ever ride a nuke?
No, never.
No, like Armageddon or Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, no.
Not it wasn't out on the tarmac.
Yeah.
Was that like forbidden? Like all the nuke handlers were like, because there's no way those enlisted guys that are loading those nukes, they didn't.
Yeah.
You know they did. You know every single one of them did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You never did that?
I never did that.
Okay. Yeah. Next question.
We'd go up, we'd have to go in the, we'd do pre-flights, you know, we'd open up in the Bombay, so you get to see them. But
yeah. Yeah. You're like, I'm just going to go check it out.
Yeah.
Selfie. No cameras allowed,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Next.
Next question is for Rich, actually. What's with the propeller?
What's with the propeller? Oh, yeah, so it's Aviation Test Flight Month. So as you guys know, we try to decorate the set here with stuff. So, you know, we talked about the ejection seat. And this is another aviation mishap, right? This is a damaged propeller that Bernie Harris donated to the club because Bernie Harris had a crash landing in this plane and kind of messed up the propeller. There's another one around here, too. But we thought this one was a cool display piece because, you know, it's got quite a curve. This is not the shape a propeller is supposed to be,
nope.
Right?
It's a new design.
But this was at the Van Nuys Airport, and the landing gear wouldn't come down. So Bernie landed that on the belly and then donated the prop to the club. Pretty intense, huh?
Yep. It's a good souvenir.
All right, next question, Andy.
Next question comes from Robert Starling. Thank you so much for your question. How much do you know about the granddaddy to the B-2, the old Northrop YB-49 flying wing of the 1940s?
Well, I'm not, you know, an aviation expert on that, but I just know it's certainly one of the predecessors to the B-2. It's that design ultimately led to the design of the B-2. Because what they learned about the flying wings was that their radar signature was much less than a conventional aircraft.
Because no vertical surfaces.
And so that was one of the things they learned when they were testing out the flying wings back in Jack Northrop's days, and so that kind of set the stage for the B-2, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Because there's another stealth fighter, the F-117, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That one must have a larger radar cross-section, right?
Okay. Can't talk about it.
Can't talk about it? I look it up on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
All right, next question, Andy.
The next question comes from Serious Improv. And Serious Improv wants to know, let me make sure I get this exactly right, what was the plane that McNamara killed because he was jealous of Skunk Works and Kelly Johnson?
That's a intense question. Mm-hmm. McNamara, like the...
He was jealous of...
Was that like a congressman?
Well, he was Secretary of Defense, right?
Correct. He was Secretary of State around the time of Kennedy, I believe.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
Serious Improv, can you tell us?
So he killed, you said, the question was...
It's like a quiz.
He killed one of Lockheed's platforms?
The question asks, what was the plane that he killed? Because he was jealous of Skunk Works and Kelly Johnson.
Oh, was it the SR-71 or...
I don't know. Maybe Serious Improv can get us back.
Yeah, Serious Improv, hit us back. Look it up, hit us back, and we'll be here next week. So
next question.
That'll be a homework assignment.
I know it was going to be a quiz show here, did you? Yeah. Final Jeopardy question.
Next question comes from Reggie Sully, and Reggie wants to know, what is the reaction of other pilots when they find out that you flew a B-2?
I don't know. That varies. I mean... Depends on what their background was, I suppose.
It's a pretty elite position that you hold.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first question is, what did I think? I mean, usually that's the first question people ask. Is what did you think about flying the B-2? So
smelled like a new airplane.
Smells like a new airplane.
Next question.
Yeah. Now that you're retired, do you ever miss it?
I get to see it, fly in the Antelope Valley there, and so every time, it flies, and I look up in the air and I say, oh, that you need to be back up in the cockpit again.
But, yeah.
But, But all I get right. I get to at least work, you know, with the people that you know still do the testing. So
yeah,
I get to,
you're pretty close.
I get to go out and take a look at it every once in a while there. So, yeah.
All right, next question.
Two final questions. One from Larry Stern, and Larry wants to know: you said that you flew approximately 20 plus aircraft while in test pilot school.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on some of those other aircraft?
List them off.
Okay. So
I'll count for you.
Okay. So you got to fly the F-4, the A-7, the F-16, okay. T-38, the A-37. We flew C-130, C-141, F-18. There was some smaller aircraft. It was a UV-18. And flew a TG-7. We've got to fly two or three different gliders. Flew a couple different helicopters.
Helicopters, huh?
Yeah.
I thought pilots kind of like picked a lane.
you get to fly a variety. Yeah.
You really can fly anything, huh?
Yeah, varieties of different things. Let's see what else. Some executive, you know, business jets like a Dassault Falcon, I think.
Yeah, you sent us a picture of a civilian-looking jet in there.
That's what I get to fly now when they let me. So that's what we refer to as a test bed. It's an old Gulfstream G2, and what we do with that particular airplane, we've ripped out all the back end as far as the seats and stuff. We put
the mini bar.
Yeah, the mini bar. Took it all that stuff, and then we put in racks so we can put different systems, payloads that we can test, and you can see it's got a big protrusion on the bottom there, and that's that allows us to carry different payloads and sensors on the bottom, and on the top it's got what we refer to as a canard on the top there, or dorsal on top. Where we can put different things up there.
Hmm.
So anyway, that allows us to go do testing on different systems before it gets fielded on an operational platform there. So
that's cool. Yeah. But to answer Larry's question, you can basically fly anything, and you basically did fly everything.
Yeah, you get to fly, yeah. Yeah,
is there any plane that you never flew that you really wanted to fly?
I didn't get a chance to fly the F-15, so that was one of the fighters I would like to have flown. But I got to, flew the F-18, the F-18 of the flew the F-16, the F-18. The F-18 is a really nice flying airplane. So
So Navy picked well on that one.
Yeah.
All right, last question.
The last question of the night comes from Michael Bershad. Have you ever seen a flying object in the air that you couldn't explain?
I've seen things. I'm not sure I would call it, it's an unidentified flying object. I'm not sure I would call it, something from another planet there, but
something. But a UFO, something flying?
Something flying.
And what was your explanation?
You just see something and it could be a natural phenomenon. It could have been another airplane that just looked, strange or different. So, but
it's like when you wake up in the middle of the night and you see a person sitting in your room and you're like, it's a coat rack.
Yeah.
Or like I threw a, so you just kind of write it off as that.
Yeah.
So you don't believe.
Yeah.
I don't know. You're flying a pretty advanced platform. Maybe the aliens are scoping you out.
Yeah. Well, if you've seen our 25-year presentation on YouTube there, you can see there's a few slides that talk to the alien aspect of it there.
So, oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Edwards is, one of those bases where they're flying crazy stuff, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So, as someone who flies the crazy stuff, maybe you have a little inside information that the rest of us don't.
As far as what you're talking, as far as aliens,
and
No, I don't have any.
Okay.
Other than making fun, that we've got a cute little patch, and that's on the. If you go look at the YouTube video on the 25 years of flight test, there's a PowerPoint slide that shows the patch there. So
you are the aliens. They've already infiltrated you.
Yeah.
We got too advanced with our weapon systems, so they took them over.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, hey, Troy, thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate you coming out to the club and giving us this talk. We appreciate your stories of adventure. Everybody out there watching, thanks for watching. We'll be here next Thursday with hopefully more aviation tales for this month. Anyway, live from the Adventurers Club, my name is Rich Mayfield, member 1211. We'll see you next week.
Okay. Thanks. It was awesome. So.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. It's an honor.
Yeah. All right.